Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need.
Before we jump into this episode, we just want to quickly mention that this was recorded before the recent encampments at various universities across Canada. And you're going to hear references that might be a little bit out of date, but we still think it's incredibly relevant to what's going on right now. And other than that, please enjoy.
I'm welcoming a lot of people to the studio today, so it's not going to be your regular introductions. We have got an eclectic group of people joining us all from all over Canada, so-called Canada. And what they represent are local groups of Palestinian solidarity activists that are springing up absolutely everywhere. They've done it on a riding basis. And like Asya just said before we started recording, it seems like there's a new one every day. So we're going to talk to them about what their experience has been like organizing at this local level, how they're networking with one another, and just how widespread this local movement is getting. So welcome, everybody. There's five. How many guests we have? We have four of you in the studio today, but you'll be sharing perspectives from a lot more groups than that. How many are there? Michelle, did you look that up for us?
I looked up so my name's Michelle and I'm from Montreal. I work in what's called the Outremont riding, which is the federal riding. And we have at least 16 groups. Like you said, they keep popping up. So there might be more today, or there might be somebody who I didn't count in the list, but I counted at least 16.
How many's Toronto got? Or you've got an Ontario count?
So I think Ontario has at least 30. And then maybe I think BC, I've seen about 8, but I feel like they're going to start growing real fast.
Do you feel like, are you all connected with one another, or are people just kind of seeing what's happening, popping up, and you're just pleasantly surprised by it?
So a lot of the groups are connected under the PAL Solidarity Canada umbrella. However, those who are not, we kind of try to rope each other in and eventually put them all in a group and then do subgroups, which is kind of how we met, because the big group is super busy and we want to keep pushing for more activities and things to bring awareness about Palestine.
So it's been really interesting because in Montreal, we have the groups that organized with PAL Solidarity Canada, who started off with federal ridings. But we also have groups that started off just because they were people in neighborhoods who wanted to come together and work. So we have some groups that are neighborhoods that aren't federal ridings, and then we kind of connect. So I found that really interesting for the organizing, too, because we can work together, but then we can also do separate things. And so it kind of makes the movement more powerful to have people kind of thinking in different ways. We've done a lot of like cross group things in that way, which I thought has been really productive.
Can you give us some examples? Like, I know I've seen two Toronto groups sharing the hosting of a film screening or other kinds of seminar, learning, education events, which is easy to double up on. But can you give me some other examples of where two different local groups are doing something together so that they don't double up on the work? Because that's the idea of creating alliances and networks, right? So not everybody is doing the same thing over and over again. But at the same time, if you're all local, you do want to replicate it. So what's that balance like? Oakville.
So to Michelle's point, our group in Oakville, we do have two federal ridings. We have Oakville and then Oakville North Burlington. We weren't founded from a concerted effort from any kind of national group. It was a pretty organic grassroots campaign. There was a ceasefire motion at our town hall here in Oakville, and the mayor then basically said that he was distraught from anti-Semitic and bullying messages that he had received, And him and the town counselors left for a recess indefinitely. And then we all kind of decided, hey, they're not going to listen to our 25 speeches that we prepared. We're going to give our speeches to one another. So then the town council kind of just became this beautiful public forum where we all made a WhatsApp chat and decided to start organizing together. So in terms of working with other groups, though, it's been really productive for us to talk to Mississauga groups, groups in Hamilton. We've arranged marches with them. And additionally, we have like a vigil coming up on Sunday. We coordinated with PYM, which is Palestinian Youth Movement, Toronto for Palestine, just to ensure there's no overlapping major events, such as a large march downtown that would conflict with our event. So that's kind of what we've been doing in the background. And we've been assisting with things like marshalling, just community support through our activism. And it's been really helpful.
I think a big, so my name is Batul. I'm from the Edmonton area. A big way that we've been looking to work together with other groups in Edmonton. So there's a bunch of different groups in Edmonton working, you know, the group centered around the Edmonton Center riding, which is Randy Boissonneau's federal riding, but also other groups within Edmonton that have just been doing other work. For example, I think we've all come to realize that economic pressure is very important in this effort, and so whether it's the SJP, the University of Alberta Students for Justice and Peace, Justice in Palestine, or if it's our group with Randy's organizing around Randy Boissonneau, we try to share our efforts in terms of pushes for BDS, and so that there are different targets, but our messaging is the same, our demands are kind of similar, and we're not redoing work that has already been done. You know, if there's a letter campaign that's in progress, then we can work together on it so that we can adapt it to our different targets and make sure that all of our efforts are in line with one another, and that, like we said, we are having that multi-pronged approach so that all avenues, all targets are feeling the pressure to divest from Israeli occupation and apartheid.
I love how Oakville's group was given their first organizing space by a bunch of cowards. That's a great story. But Ed, Batul, to your point and to that question that I asked, again, it reminds me of that episode, Santiago, we did with the anarchist collective Crime Think. And the need for groups and individuals to be able to move forward in ways that work for them, right? And that are uniquely local, because some of you are going to have conservative MPs, some of you are going to have liberal or maybe ND, like a varying receptiveness, different types of communities in that regard. But at the same time, there's an importance to keep with the demand set by Palestinians themselves, right? By the larger Palestinian resistance. So anybody want to talk about how to manage that fine line, especially talking about increasing tactics and economic blockades? Because we've talked on the show a lot about different tactics, and lobbying is generally a safe avenue. I mean, we've seen people get picked up for asking Chrystia Freeland questions too closely, but I mean, generally, but there's different risks involved with doing economic blockades and whatnot. So how do you find that balance between letting local groups branch out or subgroups act autonomously? Is that possible within your collective?
I think we always keep the Palestinian demands first and foremost in our organizing efforts, namely that we are demanding Palestinian liberation. We're not asking for ceasefire or humanitarian aid. Those aren't the demands that we're organizing around. Those are steps towards the demands that we're making. But our demands are always going to be Palestinian liberation, and those demands are set by Palestinians globally. And then once, as a national collective and as a collective of people that are organizing around this subject and around these demands, you know, we might identify an action or a target or a strategy, but then it's up to each riding to adapt those things to their individual circumstances and what's going on for them, in a way that makes sense, in a way that is most effective, and that considers the risks attached for that individual group or riding. Whether it's a sit-in, a demand for sit-ins at MP offices, you know, if somebody knows that their MP never comes to the office, then, you know, they make different arrangements. If they know that their riding or their group is not equipped to deal with a certain action in terms of resources, then, you know, they can scale it down. So it just depends on what that riding is able to do, but because those demands are always taken from the global Palestinian liberation demands, we adapt in a way that can work with those demands and never compromises them.
I just wanted to build on it. I think, yeah, you're 100% right, where each riding has to do their own thing. Even though here it's one city, some neighborhoods you just can't walk around in a kufiya with. So obviously doing things around your MP is going to be different. Eglinton, Lawrence, you can walk around in a kufiya. You're just not going to be very
comfortable. Just not on a bridge.
yeah, not on a bridge either. So you can walk around in a kufiya. You just kind of have to be mentally and physically prepared. However, for example, we had our first and so far only little block party in front of Marco Mendicino's office. And it was really nice because it was a poetry reading. And we stuck a lot of the art we had made the day before from sort of kids and other people that came to do art for Palestine and put it on his window. And because of where we are, a lot of Zionists ended up showing up, and they were very loud and rude. However, it was clear that they were confused and they didn't know what to do. They were like, how the hell do we like disturb a poetry reading? Tell me why one girl was literally just like twirling in circles.
I felt so like strange about it too, because so many of them were like really, really young. Like we're talking like teenagers.
The Zionists, you mean?
Yeah, the Zionists were there that day. And that was like, you know, you can see the indoctrination. It's like you haven't had like the lack of awareness of this, like the propaganda that has been fed into this. And, you know, it felt kind of weird about that watching it there. And then there was like the one adult who, yeah, was twirling with a Israeli flag. And it was like they wanted so badly to get a reaction, I think. It was really funny watching them not get what they wanted from that.
That has real vibes of that video that's going viral now of my brave Jewish wife standing in the middle of the student encampment, just like terrified, and everyone is just like on, it's like snack time or something. Like no one's doing anything. Some of them are dancing and wondering what's going on, and just, oh, wow. Go ahead.
I'm just going to throw in sort of, and actually answer your question. And then, sorry, Michelle, I'll give it to you. But our writing, we also like to do a lot of community building, as every writing kind of should try and do, because in the end, we're trying to get everybody on the same page, right? Whether it's about Palestine or policing, we're trying. However, we are also aware that some things are more immediate. So we try and make sure that somebody from our writing group, at least one person, is at every direct action that's happening here. Because like Batul said, disrupting the economy is probably going to be the way that we get this done. And as we're seeing, that's going to become more and more common, which Eglinton Lawrence will be very involved with. I think that's all I'll say. But Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've been working on a similar thing. We've kind of did this organically just because our group had a lot of people. And I know that many of the other Montreal groups have been doing something similar, where we've been trying to get more organized to make sure that we send at least one or two people to each thing, because there's so much happening locally, and as well trying to coordinate it, like when we can't do that with each other. We have a Montreal-wide kind of group, so we try to kind of talk about that. But I wanted to circle back and also underline this point that so much of what we're also doing is education, like what you brought up, Santiago, about, like, you know, you're watching those, you know, young people and seeing their indoctrination, but really that a lot of the actions that we do, whether they're the more direct actions or even the kind of like more MP focused things or, you know, handing out the flyers and so on, there's a lot of different types of work that the neighborhoods are doing to educate ourselves and educate each other and then educate our actual literal neighbors, which is different maybe than other kinds of organizing because it has this neighborhood feeling. We're like talking to people that we wouldn't normally necessarily talk to around this very particular thing. And I feel there's like a really a big power in this, these moments, like you said, like when you're standing there and you kind of look and, you know, something ridiculous happens or something dangerous happens or something inspiring happens and you're with, you know, someone who you live near or you're with somebody who you're there because they're part of your kind of living space. There's a different kind of environment around that that's really interesting for organizing, I think, and powerful.
Organizing at a riding level will necessitate that, right? Because we mentioned, I think, again, before we started recording, we always do that ridings aren't natural communities. They're drawn to a very specific end. So quite often, you know, they include really diverse ranges of communities within them. So my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the original purpose of doing these local level groups using the same boundaries, these kind of unnatural boundaries, was because you all had shared a common target, a political point. In Ontario, it's actually, you can count on them having the same MP and same MPPs, which makes it logistically easier, right? You can go to the door of somebody from any one of these kind of communities within a riding and maybe you have different scripts for different neighborhoods, but you have the same target, the same email address and all of that. But you're not partisan, though, because everyone, we have some people on here talking about organizing at the riding level, riding. That's usually very specific to partisan politics. And you've been dealing with a lot of politicians.
I was going to speak on just navigating risk levels and activism, but I do want to touch on also the partisan aspect of what we're doing. For example, I did go to a debate about 2 days ago in Milton, which is part of Halton Region, which is part of Oakville. And there was an NDP MPP candidate who was like, hey, can I be added to your WhatsApp group for activism?
Absolutely the fuck not.
Exactly. So it's been interesting not only navigating interactions.
Don't trust anyone that's been vetted and cleared by the NDP.
I'll second that. I was just going to say it's been interesting navigating not only interactions with kind of unfriendly and hostile politicians, but also with politicians who are kind of trying to court your community's vote. And also it's important to maintain your impartial. You're not going to necessarily endorse a candidate because, like we've seen, we have so many politicians, especially in the GTA, who are, you know, diverse. They're from different backgrounds. They could be Arab, they could be Muslim, but they're not necessarily representing the communities that they claim that they're representing when they finally get to the office or when there's pressure on them to vote within their party's line.
Can you drop some names?
I'm thinking about Omar Al-Ghafar.
Yeah.
In Mississauga.
Yeah.
And additionally, when I had a meeting with Anita Anand in Oakville with her staff's office, when we were attempting to drop off pledges in relation to the NDP's Opposition Day motion, the staff member was speaking to me and said, you know, MP Anand cares deeply about this issue as a woman of color. And initially, that set off alarm bells for me because that's kind of all talk without action to substantiate what they're saying.
What's it been like trying to leverage these politicians? Like, I want to get maybe an answer from all of you if possible, because here on the show, let's just say the show was born from the dismay of the political system. So to say I'm skeptical of efforts to lobby politicians is an understatement. Right. So when you talk economic blockades, I'm here. But appealing to folks like Marco Mendicino, I understand a block party outside of his house is not an appeal to him whatsoever. But generally, can you speak to what you think those specific efforts have yielded, trying to get them to at least endorse a ceasefire, the steps that Batul talked about to get to the ultimate goal? But, you know, we've not seen a lot of movement. No? I'll see you.
So I just want to go first because I am straight off the bat, that's not what we're doing with Marco Mendicino. He's a very racist, Islamophobic person. So we actually went in, like, we gathered as a group and kind of decided that we're not going to convince this guy who dismisses Muslims and Palestinians. We are just here to make sure that there's always something bothering him, kind of like a mosquito. And we've done that thing. We've sent hundreds of emails and calls and whatever, and he hasn't responded. So we've already done the formal thing, but we did it knowing he wasn't, like, we did it knowing he was not going to answer. We've gotten into his office a couple times. However, it's pretty difficult. They lock it. They get you to call because no drop-ins allowed, allegedly. And so what they do is when you call, they look out the window and, like, they decide.
So you have, like, to take your kafia has to be in your bag at least, or you're not getting in.
Yeah. So we actually saw some staffers this one time when we walked up with our kafias, turn off the lights, close the blinds, and go sit at their desks and put headphones on. So
this is, like, so familiar.
It's so bad. Like they're actually, like, they're so disconnected. And you know, this is just his staffers. He doesn't, when we asked them, well, why can we get a meeting with him? His staffers said they don't have access to his schedule. And he gets to choose which emails that he wants to get back to. So they just told us, well, he heard your issue. He doesn't really give a shit. And he also doesn't let us see his schedule as far as they want to tell us for obvious reasons. So we're not here to convince this racist guy.
A shared calendar with your MP?
We're not here to convince him. And we're just here to make sure that he knows he's being watched. Whatever he decides to work as in the future, he's going to be watched then. All these photos that come up with you when you look at reviews for him are our protest photos or little reviews. We're not the only ones who that have had problems with him, by the way, but that's a whole other story. And then also to make sure that the next people who run for this riding know that there's a group of people who are going to hold you accountable and make your life hell from the start if you decide to dismiss Palestine. So our goal is not, like, reaching this guy's heart who thinks he has faced discrimination because he's Italian. It's other things. So I'll let everybody else go now that everybody knows we're not trying to do that.
Thank you for clearing up.
Well, ours is probably pretty similar to yours, Asya. I mean, I think that's how we met in the first place, right, in the national organizing, because we have a similar kind of MP. The MP in my riding is Rachel Ben-Dayan, was she the third or the fourth most lobbied by Sija in the recent report that came out, and has, you know, stood with Anthony Hausfather and kind of done a lot of work that has upheld Zionism and so on, but also tries to at the same time present herself, and this was interesting from what you said, Oakville, and so on, as somebody who really cares very much about racialized communities. And one third of the neighborhood of Côte des Neiges in Montreal is part of the Outremont Federal Riding. So there's this idea that kind of there's some people who are good to be in photo ops with lots of sort of young racialized kids for certain kinds of photo ops, but then, like, where the attention that she pays in terms of what she does in Parliament is actually to a different part of the riding. So our group also made very similar decisions about thinking how to deal with the question of what we're doing to advocate for Palestine and to work for Palestinian liberation, given that our MP is a Zionist. And it's been, you know, it's been interesting because it creates a lot of conversations. Like, what do you do? She did a very similar thing. She won't respond to our calls. She doesn't come into her office. She's been out of her office completely. And so on. I won't go through the whole story. You can look at our socials for that. We've done a big campaign about it. But other neighborhoods in Montreal face really similar kinds of questions, too. We have a Trudeau. So the Papineau pour la Palestine riding, Trudeau is their MP. So how do they organize, right? What do you organize when that's your MP? We have Melanie Joly, so the Ahuntsic Cartier riding, that's AC for Palestine, is, you know, trying to pressure Joly. So I think that, you know, we've had to use lots of different ways of thinking about what our role as people are when those are our representatives. I think the majority of the people that I've worked with either came into this not necessarily believing in federal politics, or have learned through the process of joining one of these groups and working on the question of Palestine that federal politics doesn't work for us, that we don't actually have a voice, that we are ignored and nobody listens to us. And so we've learned a lot about federal electoral politics in doing the work. So that's been a really cool part of this, like, organizing, is to really understand not just how it can work for you, but how it actually can't.
I agree. That's been the biggest story of these efforts to organize around federal ridings, is the complete refusal to even engage with protesters, with concerned community members, with anybody that they don't agree with or don't want to give an ear or a platform to. And there's no recourse to it within the democratic system. There's nothing to force them to meet with us, even though we're their constituents and that's supposedly what their job is. It's very frustrating. But then in that process, I think we've come to realize that we do still need to place pressure on them, because that pressure builds up to those higher ups, like Melanie Joly, like Trudeau, because, for example, like Randy Bosano is a Liberal MP. He's the only Liberal riding in Edmonton. And his campaign was built on like LGBTQ community support. But then when Queers for Palestine or other groups try to reach him or organize around that, like to say, like, this is the community that you mobilize to vote for you, to give you this seat, and you're not listening to our demands on Palestine. I mean, it's complete blockout. There's no engagement still. And so, you know, it seems like he's resigned himself to not being reelected anyways. And so he doesn't feel any pressure. So outside of this system where the concern of the politicians is their next office, there's not really a way. There's democracy doesn't work, and we've seen that. What does work is agitation. What does work is disruption. What does work is economic blockades and economic disruptions. Those things actually feed into the pressure that we're building up and hopefully hoping to kind of pressurize the system as a whole. So, you know, even while we're organized around these individual and specific MPs and ridings, the real goal is overall pressure, and to sustain it and to build it up as long as possible so that it pops and something gives.
I want to put down a t-shirt, like, democracy doesn't work, what does work is agitation and disruption.
It's gonna be the tagline for our podcast. We'll credit you, but none of this surprises me. I think, like, a lot of people who've been involved, like, have understood that democracy doesn't work for them. But there are still a lot of people that are learning this for the first time, or the extent of its futility. And I find that heartwarming because I want nothing but to pull people out of the fucking legislature and into the streets, honestly. Because, you know, even, you know, anybody who's ever been involved in the NDP, that was your first clue that it doesn't work for us. Because even the ones that say that, oh, no, we work for you specifically, they don't. So it's very, like, I could see Santiago smiling to, well, he, you know, the whole t-shirt comment, but his head always whips around when someone's like, no, agitation, disruption. He's like, yes, yes, because we start talking about sending emails again, my head's going to explode. Not that, I'm not talking about you folks, that's a dig at the NDP trying to solve the CAFEA ban in the Ontario legislature at the moment. But
also, one more thing about NDP
organizing, feel free. I guess. Let's just shit on them for a second.
Well, just one thing that's like kind of refreshing in this conversation that was a pain back in like when I thought NDP organizing was an answer was like, you know, the writings were super disconnected when you were doing that. Like it felt like little islands and stuff. And you were kind of subtly discouraged from talking to anybody in any other writing or organizing together. So just like kind of seeing how that's, you know, with this kind of organizing, you know, it's writing based, but it's not limited to like the physical writings and that there's all this communication going on. That's already like so much more powerful and more effective than what happens in the NDP. Just wanted to share that real quick. Oakville, I saw your hand up.
I did just want to add, like I'm from the Southern United States originally. That's where I was born and raised and spent most of my life. So it's been really interesting for me to go from seeing politicians who don't care if you have, you know, clothes on your back and will make it very clear to your face that they feel that way, to kind of these performative, placating politicians who will say things that sound very nice and sound like they care about you, but in reality they don't. I did just want to mention like an anecdote because we were talking about, you know, these disruptions that are economic blockades or that things that are actually more effective when you realize, you know, engaging in democracy and bureaucracy can only take you so far. We've had a lot of interesting and difficult conversations within our own organizing group regarding navigating relations with the police, if we should inform them of our protest routes, if we should inform them of our activities, give them a contact for our group.
No. I hope that's the answer you all came to, yeah? No.
But that's a good education. It's good education to do, right? You all are doing like that's the best education, right? People to people. Like saying no, like this is how we have to organize. This is how we have to move forward. It's
when
hard.
You have such
it's
a big
work.
Umbrella, though, that can be a tough conversation with some folks, right? We talked to a group at a St. John's and they had money stolen from them from a treasurer, but they are an anti-police organization, right? They believe in social justice. So those two things are not compatible. And they have a really eclectic group, a wide umbrella, some people that would consider themselves, you know, small L liberals, that's okay. You know, they do the work, but, or even maybe are anti-police, like from an understanding that they do only harm, but still wanted vengeance in some way, you know, like still had to work that out of their system. It wasn't just naturally the group came to the decision that no, they wouldn't charge them and they wouldn't go to the police and they would find other ways to navigate it. So the navigating needs doing, but just for all those people out there that are listening, the answers from me would be a hard no. See, are you going to argue
with
me?
It's difficult.
No, I think Oakville actually had something to finish, and then I'll go
after. Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, it's difficult when you have someone in your group who's like, hey, my brother's a cop, and he's 100% pro-Palestine. Like, not all cops are that bad. And then it kind of snowballs into, like, a longer conversation about, you know, group safety. And I think something else that is connected to this topic that I just want to touch on very briefly is, you know, when we discuss these subgroups or people, you know, taking their own initiatives within our organizations, it kind of makes you think about, to what extent can we protect our branding as a group? For example, we had a subgroup kind of in our umbrella that was arranging for like a small demonstration at our town hall. And, you know, I looked at the group chat of that group and people were saying, oh, are we going to storm the town hall building? And then when you think about that, you know, there's no marshals. They don't have the same protocols that we have with Oakville for Palestine. And it kind of makes you feel like, okay, so what? To what extent can we protect our branding and our image and ensure that we're always keeping each other safe, be it without law enforcement?
Yeah, there's definitely a concern about that because, I mean, you can't stop other people from organizing within the city, you know, and taking up their own actions. But you know, I mean, certain times some people are not happy with the level of disruption or the level of agitation that's happening. And you don't really know if they've considered the risks effectively. And then other times there's people that are willing to, you know, take a more liberal approach and think that there is some type of positive to be gained from that, from engaging with MPs, engaging with cops and things like that. And, you know, like, it's a balancing act of trying to advise or keep an eye on other groups and ensure that, you know, Palestinian demands are not being compromised, first and foremost. And then secondly, that safety and risk is being considered, because not everybody has the same risk tolerance. And that's just something that needs to be considered when making these types of organizing decisions. But I'm not a dictator. Like, I can't stop anybody from doing their actions. I just, if I am aware of it, I'm like, have you thought about this? Do you have a plan for that?
Yeah. I just kind of wanted to throw in that I do think having both the, you know, disrupting the economy, but also pressuring politicians and gathering the community, I think they need each other, to be honest. I think educating the community, building a relationship, seeing that, you know, making sure that people know that Palestinians are real people, Muslims and Arabs are real people, and sort of reaching out to neighbors and building those connections helps, especially when mainstream media does this really, really terrible coverage and really racist coverage of Palestinian demonstrations. And then especially the demonstrations that do bother people. They, you know, they hold up traffic, or they're holding up a train. They're, well, stopping the flow of money, which angers people. But when they understand, there's a lot more empathy. And I think historically, we've kind of witnessed that having those two hand in hand is really good. As for the policing thing, I, in my group's opinion, and I feel very confident saying this on behalf of Eglinton Loris and Don Valley, is we don't think it's safe to do anything with the police. There's a reason why we have marshals at all the protests, at all our little events. It's because we have to protect our members from violent Zionists and from whatever other group. But we also have to protect them from the police, which to this day, the police has harmed much more, many more people at our events than they have helped. So everyone might not agree, because that is true. There are literally cops in this movement who are related to, like, organizers. So maybe not Toronto specifically, but there are. And I think that's really scary and harmful. And we're kind of working on how to explaining to people that the police is not, they're not your friends. And we're kind of working on doing something to integrate that into communities that are not super exposed to all this stuff. For example, you know, Arab immigrants usually come here and they think, well, this is a democracy. Their authority sort of, you know, it must be good. The police really must be there to protect you. So you should show them respect. And a lot of these immigrants end up having to do a 180 once they see what's happening right in front of their face, once they see their community members being harmed and in a couple cases now permanently injured. So when you do that outreach, which I'm hoping will be kind of one of the bigger things that we do, you know, we're going to be talking to different communities and seeing what they understand about policing and what might actually reach them. So once you build that community, you can do the economic actions even more. Yeah, I think that was it for me.
And that definitely rings true. It's like you have to build up that community awareness I've been seeing that so much of the Canadian public is completely out of touch and out of tune with the political machinations that run the country. And so that education piece is so important. Like you said, Asya, about informing people of what the effects and what the outcomes of these actions can be, and also bringing people into an understanding of empire, colonial rule, and policing, the links and systems in between all of those different things, so that they can understand why Palestinians are protesting in Canada, or why people are protesting for Palestine in Canada. What does Canada have to do with it? That's a question that still gets asked. Why we don't work with the police, and what are the outcomes that can come from these different types of disruptive actions? So I totally agree. Sorry.
Just, I want to let you ask your next question, but I just want to throw in that I don't know about the rest of the policing organizations in Canada are, but TPS trains with the IOF. They train with the people that are committing the murder. Like, why do you think the police is going to protect you if they're using the training, being used to commit a genocide? What are TPS going to learn from that? Does that mean they're going to be using those tactics on you? Like, it just takes a little bit of reflection to go into that. But yeah, go ahead.
And organizers out there that are having these tough discussions, because, you know, you're bringing people in that just haven't gotten there yet. Like, we don't want them to always have to face a baton or see their friends get smashed before they get to that point. You need to hold that line. There needs to be discussions, but you need to create police-free zones in order to have safe organizing spaces. They cannot be allowed in your organizing spaces, period, or else you're actually excluding a ton more people. You're going to exclude undocumented people. You're going to exclude sex workers. You're going to exclude anybody that's been criminalized for any reason. They will not feel safe in your spaces. So if you think that's one less person at your action, one less skill to draw upon, let it go. Let it the fuck go. Not everyone needs to be brought along. That's police included. I just had to interject that, because the idea that there's groups out there organizing for Palestine that have police in them. I mean, some of you have police in them and you just don't know, but you don't need to let them in just through the fucking front door. That's not cool. So please get there if you're not there already. We've got a playlist for you. We'll share it in the show notes. A million and one reasons why we keep us safe and the police absolutely do not. But yeah, that's become a real reality for folks organizing in the Palestinian solidarity movement. And wanted to ask you folks, because we probably won't get a chance to talk about it separately, but we're seeing a lot of campuses in the United States and here in Canada, McGill comes to mind, that are taking over spaces on their university, encampments, occupations, you can call them whatever you want. And some are being met with incredible police resistance. But I was saying to Santiago today, and anyone that would listen to me, that I am incredibly impressed with not just their fortitude and commitment to the cause, because these aren't your usual suspects, right? But their skills in repelling police attacks. They have practiced. They know how to line up. They know how to grab one another so that they can't be grabbed. They know what to do when someone does get grabbed by the police. They are bringing umbrellas and shields. They're building barricades. I get tingles talking about it. Anybody building a barricade, it's got great vibes for me. Honestly, I'm sorry. Like, I'm excited. So, but on the flip side, you know, you have to make sure people are prepared for this. And if you're talking about economic blockades, you can guarantee that, you know, that means some of your members and your comrades that you're organizing along with will get hauled off by police or, you know, in a confrontation of some sort. Are you doing stuff as organizations, as organizers, to prepare your people for this?
I think a lot of this is actually being recycled from BLM, where we're seeing the guides they made and how they repel police, how they protect each other. And we even saw it kind of being used yesterday when they de-arrested somebody. I can't remember what university it was, but they were able to do that. And now we're receiving these PDF guides left and right, as well as like Instagram sort of slides to tell you, here's how you protect yourself. Here's how you protect yourself from batons. Here's how to protect yourself from, the smoke. I forget what it's called. tear gas. And here's how you hold a line when you're pushing, and here's how you hold a line when you're being pushed, which is crazy. But I think, like, I'm really excited as well. I'm hoping people learn these things. Our riding specifically is the only thing right now that we're working on to prepare for that, is this sort of the police that aren't your friends social media campaign. And I think some bigger groups will be interested in seeing that. And a lot of our content is actually inspired and based off of a New York group. But I think, Batul, can I throw this to you? Because I know U of A kind of did something the other day.
Yeah, so the University of Alberta, SJP, organized a 12-hour sit-in or encampment on the University of Alberta campus. From what I saw, there wasn't, you know, admin retaliation. We would love to see that blossom into something more longstanding, but we are worried about resources and support and sustaining a type of action like that. So a lot of the work that we've been doing in Edmonton over the past 6 months has been about building capacity to take on more actions like that. But it just depends on resources and judging what the response will be and what the risk will be. I think we don't really have a great frame of reference for what risk or response will happen for certain actions. And so it just makes it a little bit hard to plan.
I think it was impressive, like, how fast U of A was able to pull something together. And I know they don't have the people or the resources the way that Ontario groups have, but I thought it was really great that they were able to do, like, days ago, a 12-hour sit-in, because they probably just couldn't sit there and watch everything happen and not do anything about it.
It went into place so quickly, and I think it was the first Canadian university to kind of respond to these encampments happening on American university campuses. And so it's bringing us into that conversation and into that path, and I hope to see more universities in Canada taking on that approach, because we have seen a lot of other campuses protesting and advocating for Palestine and for divestment for their universities. And similar to the American campuses, you know, there's been very poor responses, you know, always the scapegoat of anti-Semitism, always the scapegoat of addressing Islamophobia, but not actually addressing Palestine, anti-Palestinian racism, and not actually addressing the economic ties between universities and Israeli occupation, apartheid, and genocide. And so SJP has been, the University of Alberta SJP has been engaged in making those demands and asking those questions for a really long time. And it was really amazing to see them escalate that to that sit-in and that occupation. And I'm hoping that the university admin and the university community at large takes that seriously.
Well, that's another economic pressure point that we didn't bring up, but that I imagine the university groups are still engaged in and have been since I was there, is the divestment from specifically Israeli arms manufacturers and the tech that goes with it. A lot of movements started just simply as a divestment from weapons manufacturers, although it had the intention of stopping the Zionists' supply. It was easier to be couched in a more general divest from weapons, because universities shouldn't be investing in weapons. But as we can see, With the facade of Zionism falling, now it become a lot more explicit in the demands that we are in fact targeting Israel and their supply.
We had one anecdote story where we were doing a march in our downtown Oakville, and a member of our group is a firefighter, and he's had very positive interactions with the police through his work because they work very closely together. He's a white male. So, you know, we're doing this march, and even though he's someone who's pro-Palestine, he's buddying up with the cops. He's saying, "Hey, how are you, Joe?" And he's, you know, trying to tell them our protest route. And we kind of had to pull him aside and say, "Hey, even though you've had this interaction with law enforcement, not everyone in our group is protected and feels safe communicating this with the authorities." So that was kind of a tough conversation to have. And in terms of how we've kept each other safe within our organization, we've arranged for martial training. We had a pretty big webinar with a lot of members of our group with someone who's an experienced police liaison. And we always do have a police liaison on site to talk to the cops to keep everyone safe. So that's just some mitigations we've done on our end to prevent police violence against our members. And it's been pretty effective thus far.
Yes, I saw you grab your head with the thought of one of the attendees sharing the route with cops. Like, no, what are you doing?
Oh, my God. I've seen this happen. And I've seen, like, organizers shake hands with cops that have taken down friends of mine and arrested them. And I just had to walk away because I was like, this is not going to look good for Eglinton Lawrence if I do something right now. But I know it's like, that's all. Like, that's all. That's just kind of what went through my head.
Asya, you said something that I didn't want to make, you know, my group look bad. And Oakville, you talked about, you know, protecting the brand, right? And we kind of understand, I think the people listening, you know, you want donations, you want to bring people in, you don't want to scare people off. It's there is a balance between in doing that. But one thing that I get concerned about, because like I red flags go off when I hear this discussion happening, is who gives a shit? I mean, you have no idea what will actually inspire people and draw them to you, for one, right? Look at politics, we'll confirm that for you. Like, the dry ones don't inspire anybody. And the only people fighting right now is they've got all our attention, Sarah Jamma. And please, like, there's also a real danger it holding anything back within your movement. And I know that sounds scary. Like, you don't want people storming the city hall. You're not ready for it. You didn't prepare for it. Yes, they might be unsafe, but they're adults, or they're you. They're where they need to be mentally and preparedly. You have to, you know, let it go sometimes too. And because that was the beauty of our conversation with the Anarchist Collective, is like every single individual person's desires and needs like have to be met in a certain way. And harmony isn't created by uniformity, right? Like, and I guess your subgroups will allow you to do that with a little more distance. You can always create subgroups that like have no branding at all, right? Like they are not affiliated whatsoever. And that can be an outlet for activities that are times hard sells in the larger group. But holding it back at this point is not an option. People are really angry.
I kind of want to tell the story then from that interview real quick. And we'll probably won't include this because the audience already heard it, but of they were mentioning about how, you know, they were organizing in a small town. It was like Occupy era. And there was a group of individuals in their organization who wanted to do a occupation of like the main town square. And how a lot of people, they weren't ready for that. They were like a little bit, you know, scared about doing that. They had concerns, but in the end the chair told them, okay, everyone who's interested in going to do this, go over here, go talk about this, go plan this, and, you know, let's talk logistics here, right? And initially it was only like your usual folks, like the ones who are ready to or you know, your balaclava anarchists, you know, who are ready to go. But as they like planned this and organized it, it ended up being that the entire organization came together and
ended up supporting it and that being a successful occupation. And it was one of those things where it's like, not everyone was ready for that, but by allowing space for something like that to happen, it went down. And, you know, I feel like our groups are often held back by like not being
ready. We think we're not ready, but the part of the story I feel you kind of left out there, the detail was the people that were ready or thought they were ready to, you know, occupy a space, just did it. And they did it okay overnight, but their comrades wouldn't let them do it alone, right? They demonstrated it could have been done. And so, you know, you kind of had to eat your pie and be like, okay, you know, I was wrong. It was possible. But also, like, it was natural, right? Once your comrades were in there doing it, like, then it became, okay, we're doing it. They've pulled us along. So sometimes those fringe people that scare us, or those actions that, you know, seem ridiculous, are actually the ones that pull the movement along. Like, a movement like this just can't stall, right? Like, that is just not an option. And you can't have people thinking that they don't have an outlet, like, just in general, not even within the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, just, like, if we're talking about bringing everybody into it. It's those right-wingers that are given outlets, right, like, and targets and escalating options that are coalescing around something fucking ridiculous, but they're coalescing, right? And they're getting their anger out, and, you know, you don't want to learn much from them, but that is a lesson.
I think there's a lot of truth to what you both said and, you know, the story that you provided. I think we don't want to be like a corporation that's wagging our finger in their faces and giving them a cease and desist for using our logo or anything like that. But I do believe at its core, we need to always center Palestinian messaging with the people of Gaza, with the people who are in the diaspora here need and want from us to be saying and iterating. I do think that, you know, sometimes it's, if you're part of activism, it's okay to also take a step back if you know that you do not have the strongest messaging to provide, that you're not fully in the know of what to say. I think of two instances. I went to a rally a couple of weeks ago at Pierre Poliev's, I think it was some kind of Nathan Phillips Square Israel party.
The way that like a Bring Them Home rally.
Yes, the Bring Them Home rally. And there was a speaker there who is not Palestinian and I was not very familiar with, who said some anti-Semitic messaging that I would actually deem to be anti-Semitic and not just legitimate criticism of Israel. And I saw a lot of Palestinians who are in the GTA were very infuriated by that, because it's very easy for Zionists to then misalign the entire movement when they latch on to these examples. And the other day I was at a rally and someone asked to borrow my megaphone. And the first question I asked is, what are you planning on saying? And of course, it was something extremely egregious and ridiculous. So, I mean, I think it's important to not gatekeep to the point where nothing is getting done and we're just being control freaks and we're being like Starbucks suing their union over using their name, versus, you know, controlling our messaging, making sure that we're organized and steadfast in what we want to achieve.
I just want to clear up that when I said I need to take a step back, it's because I was very angry in the moment. Eglinton Lawrence, I think we're all very confident in the kind of group that we have. So we know if anybody does something, we're going to back them up. We know who this group is. However, I knew that if I did something, if I got angry and I said the wrong things, it was going to create problems for no reason. It's a lot better to go talk to this organizer afterwards, which is what I often do. Or I talk to somebody who is kind of a bit higher up, or does the organizing for the marshalling or things like that. So it's not that we're being held back, because I think ELDB actually has gotten in a lot of trouble these last few months for our Farhan Ali post, which, by the way, that was about half of the tea that we had on this guy.
What are you doing with the other half?
We are protecting the people whose stories they belong to.
Your TikTok, that,
like, yeah, I promise you we're not holding back. However, Oakville is right. We've seen in this movement that sometimes drama totally takes the message away from what's actually happening, and this could actually cause problems between the organizers, because this is really like mentally, emotionally, and physically tiring when you have people who are supposed to be working with you questioning you left and right. It's like, it's okay to sometimes protect the peace. But I wasn't really scared of anything. I think because I did take that to somebody and there was a problem and part of that problem was taken care of. So it is okay to kind of wait a bit sometimes. Honestly, Oakville said it best. I don't know what kind of statement Sija sent to all the politicians to talk about Mount Sinai, but basically same thing, like bullshit unrelated to Palestine, big thing that the news can kind of grab and use. These kinds of things, just like the guy from that Nathan Phillips Square, what he did takes away from it. And it's really important to protect the messaging.
Absolutely. But when you bring up Mount Sinai, I think it's an example of no matter what you do, there will be drama created and slander leveled your way and claims of anti-Semitism all the time. That's not to say that, like, you don't let people on the mic that are going to be spouting actual anti-Semitic shit, because you just don't let that go down in any of our spaces, not because it makes the movement look bad, right? Or not because it creates it tension. But my point to you was not so much like not to start conflict within your movement, but just always having to it's not of your creating, it's of the media and the atmosphere that we're in, where folks have to second guess their tactics, not based on how impactful it might be or whether they're resource ready, but then they also have to consider, what will that make us look like? What will they say about this location that we've picked outside of a synagogue? Or, you know, what buildings are you climbing on, Spider-Man? Will you be photographed from an angle that makes it look ridiculous? Because, like, that's a lot of overthinking that folks that you're describing, like, with time, energy, and emotional toll, shouldn't have to be doing, you know? And that's frustrating. It's a necessity, and it's things like, you know, you might want to consider, but it shouldn't be necessary, you know, especially when we're talking from a Palestinian resistance movement that's an armed resistance as well, that, you know, when we're talking about messaging completely, it should be led by Palestinian voices. But I don't know if there's tactics there that are off the table in terms of ending an occupation, as in being like any kind of disrespect to the Palestinians themselves. You know what I'm saying? So, but is there anything else that you folks had prepared in your notes there that you wanted to say, maybe a story? We got to go back, circle back to the youth. Okay, Michelle, I'll go. I'm going to throw to you in a second here. So we had Eglinton Lawrence Don Valley on a few months back. I have no sense of time anymore. And it was a room of young faces. I didn't ask anybody their age, but, you know, it was refreshing. And just this last weekend, I was able to take my dad downtown to the action outside of Union Station. And although we didn't make it in time to see the different delegations group up with one another, I really wanted to take him down to see you folks. And I knew we weren't going to make it, so the whole subway ride down, I talked about you. His time here is limited. And he's always been an advocate for Palestine and against apartheid. From when I was a young girl, I understood South African apartheid because of him. And I didn't know what it would be like for him not to know where the movement would be going. And I needed to show him the youth. I was bragging about your signs with the watermelon. Look at, like, they're branded. The people can find them. They can see, like, I'm in Toronto Pie Park. Oh my God. And wander over there and meet one another. And they were holding a delegation meeting ahead of time, so people could, like, meet people from their neighborhood, like the most organic way of organizing. It's like textbook what you folks are doing. It's like all the things we've talked about. It's so promising. to see it led by such young people with such a huge understanding that, like, folks my age right now took so much longer to come around to. And like, you know, you walk on the work that came before you, right? But I feel like you youth are now at this point where you're fucking ready. And watching those university students fight with police and just seeing politicians just, like, give up the facade, it's not a desperate moment, you know what I mean? It was a very promising moment, and I want to thank you folks for just being that demonstration that I could show my dad that, like, there is a torch that is being carried on, like, and it is big, you know, and they're bringing a lot of people along with them. So do you guys want to talk about the fact that most of the groups seem to be led or spearheaded by people that are quite young, at least compared to me?
I want to talk about something you said first, and then everybody else can talk about the youth. But that's funny because, like, when I go to demonstrations or direct actions that are pretty risky, I always think it's really cool, and I want to talk to the people who are in their 70s and 80s who are there, because I'm like, oh my god, like, you lived 70, 80 years of your life and you still have, like, hope. And it must be so amazing to see what it's like 70 years ago versus today. I mean, they saw, like, actual change. So I actually think it's really nice, because I'm like, I hope I still have that kind of life in me in, like, 40 years, if we're still around. But yeah.
I think you said that to me, Asya, when we first met on one of these kind of calls. So, you know, I don't know if I'm not 70 yet. You know, I'm getting there. But I want to pick up on it, because I actually really, I really appreciate you sharing your story, Jess. But also Asya's point, right? There is this something right now in the movement that is so inspiring and important, I think, because it's multi-generational. Genuinely multi-generational. And when you go in the neighborhood groups are multi-generational, and they're also youth-led. And the youth are doing all the things, right? The youth are very organized and working very, very hard. And I keep going to meetings, and I am the oldest person in the room by double. And, you know, and I'm talking to people who are so brilliant and just have so much knowledge and so much spirit and energy, but also, like, organizing skills. And, you know, so there is this, like, very strong youth movement, which I think is so strong because the people are great, but also, and also because they're building on the movement that came before, right? Because there have been generations of this, and whereas maybe our generations weren't as organized or weren't as mobilized or weren't able to do all of the things, all those things that we and the people before us did laid a groundwork for these brilliant young people to come in and just run, right? And to be able to move very quickly and to put it together in really, really intelligent ways. So, like, it's both, right? And it's working in a lot of the spaces. And I see it a lot in the neighborhoods, because the neighborhoods are, they're very youth energized and they're very youth organized. And there are lots of older people plugging in as well. That's definitely true in our context. And it's true in the nationwide as well. So I think that it's something that's very important and empowering about the neighborhood organizing. And we've talked a lot about it in our group, but also in Montreal groups in general, and in just other groups when we meet. And the watermelon signs is how I met my first folks from Toronto in Ottawa, because we had our neighborhood banner and they had their neighborhood watermelon sign. And we went up and we're like, we're a neighborhood group from Montreal. And they said, we're the neighborhood group from Toronto. And then we met, and then we connected afterwards online. And right. So, like, it's working right here. So I find that one of the most important things to kind of keep coming back to.
Anybody else? No.
I was just going to add, personally, I'm 23 and I'm one of the admins and leaders of Oakville for Palestine. So a lot of our group is very young, you know, we're mid to late 20s. And I think a lot of what has disrupted decades of Zionist indoctrination has been the power of social media. You know, like, so many of our boomer relatives that were always saying, oh, you're on your phones all the time, disconnect from technology, with there's definitely some truth to that. But also, we're now seeing technology being used in a way that's disseminating information that's disrupting the mainstream narratives that have been built and crafted and billions of dollars have been funneled into them. People are now going on Instagram and seeing someone in Gaza saying, hey, here's my kitchen where I used to eat breakfast every morning. This is what's happened to it. And people are now starting to have the wheels turn and having those narratives disrupted that they've, you know, been fed for so long. So I think a lot of it is the power of independent journalism, the power of social media getting the messaging out there, and the power of how we've been able to also leverage it for our organizing through educational materials, through actions. Very recently, we had a Zionist in our community in Oakville. He went to a secondary school of a Catholic school here in Oakville, and he distributed his book called Israel Repairing the World to all of the students. So when we, sorry, go ahead.
All of them? Like the school let him?
To all of the students who are in this grade 7 history class. So when we heard about that, we said we need to take some kind of action because the same indoctrination tactics are now being used and we have concrete evidence of it. So, you know, we took some photos of the book, we uploaded it to social media, and within days we got thousands of people who were able to use our action network and send letters to the Catholic school board, to the school administrators, and now we're finally getting some responses. We're working on getting a Palestinian educator and historian to come speak to the class. So, you know, it's all about how we've been able to use the age of technology that we're in and how we've been able to get Palestinian voices to be centered rather than, you know, what's been told to the public for so long.
That's horrifying to think, like, how many times that might happen and folks don't get a hold of it. They're allowed
to do that. Can I add something?
Always.
So I think it has, like, what Oakville mentioned, it makes sense why the U.S. is working on banning TikTok. We'll see where that goes. They're not going to disappear. They're just going to find a new app. Like, they're just going to have to get used to it. But the other thing, I know you keep wanting to talk about youth, and I'm sorry, I keep wanting to not talk about youth.
No, let's move on. Don't worry.
That's good. It's good to.
I feel like I always have to mention this. Like, the ideologies and opinions that I have are 100% because of my grandparents, my mom. That's because my grandfather fought in our independence war in Algeria, and he was captured and released, and he didn't snitch or anything. Obviously, that history was passed down to my mother, and my mom passed that on to me. So as much as I would love to say that the youth are discovering everything, I think a lot of our history, when it's taught to us, really, really is the reason that a lot of people today understand what's going on. That's why you have a lot of, like, African, Southwest Asian kids who already are like, yeah, I mean, I'm Tamil. This happened to our people. I can connect it to here. I'm Kashmiri. I'm Congolese. I'm Sudanese. Just everybody who's been colonized at some point can, not always, clearly, for some politicians here. I don't know why Rishi Sunak is the guy that came up in my head, but clearly people like that are not always going to learn. They're not always going to make that connection. But I think it's really important that even though some previous generations were not able to take it to the goal, they basically passed on the goal and made sure that we could do something to help keep pushing for the liberation of all these places that are colonized. And yeah, anyways, that's, yeah, I just wanted to throw that in because I think that's so important. Also, it's very cool that a lot of the kids in the Ivy Leagues are just like seriously rich kids who probably have some friends that are connected to this whole issue. They talked at some point and are now doing something about it.
Oakville, I see your hand up. Let's think of kind of like final thoughts, whether like from your neck of the woods or whatnot. And then, yeah, we'll make sure we hit everybody on the way out.
Sorry, I just did just want to add, like when I was growing up in America, I was taught in school that Palestinians celebrated after 9/11. We were given so much anti-Palestinian racist material, and I was being the only Arab, the only Muslim kid in class. I was the only one to kind of stick my hand up and say, hey, something's off about this, teacher. Can you work with me on this? At like 16 years old. So, and I'm seeing a lot of my friends who are in the same classrooms who were fed the same indoctrination materials posting online about Palestine and joining these encampments in the U.S. So it's really heartening to see, you know, you have to remember these people are also unlearning so much propaganda that's pushed in the United States, and it's codified in the United States education system in order to enable Zionist interests and keep the welfare state of Israel funded and supported for generations. But in terms of final thoughts, we're just keep, I want everyone to remember that even though we are a youth-led movement, I think a lot of people always push for, oh, we need to disrupt Trudeau, we need to focus on these very high-level politicians. But a lot of the important organizing work happens at the local level, and it gets lost in translation. That's how we end up having very toxic, very harmful local politicians, because people are not coming out for the elections, they're not participating in who is actually in their riding. So I think my main message would just be for all of the youth to not only be energized and activated for, you know, our big dog politicians and the decision makers in terms of foreign policy and what's impacting people in Gaza, because we need to also focus on local level organizing and ensuring that we're putting the pressure where it counts in our own communities.
It's really great that you bring it up like that, Oakville. I love it. Like this idea of us working more in our communities. Like I said, kind of this, what I opened with is like, I was really skeptical of organizing around a federal riding, and I wasn't very excited to think about pressuring a local politician who I knew was a Zionist. It just didn't really interest me. But the more I got working in my neighborhood group, the more I realized, you know, it's not, it's about that, but it's also not about that, right? It's about building our power in our neighborhood. It's about meeting our neighbors. It's about bringing everyone together. And if I can circle it back also to both of your points, Oakville and Asya, you know, it's about working young people and old people and middle people and, you know, all of us together, coming together and using our different, you know, those of us who have, you know, the intergenerational knowledge is to bring our intergenerational knowledge to the table, bringing Algeria to the table, bringing all of these different kinds of experiences and knowledges and backgrounds that we have to fight for the in this case, the liberation of Palestine. And the liberation of Palestine, it's linked to the liberation of all of us, right? It's to all of us, like, living in a better world, it being free from occupation and colonialism. So if we think about it in those terms, all of that together is kind of what the neighborhood groups are doing. That's like, you know, very big picture, but it's really about that, like everyday local small steps with it. So I appreciate that a lot, yeah.
I feel like I'm a terrible one to close off with, because I just wanted to bring in Brampton. I was really excited about their group, because there are, like, some of the people leading that group, it's just a couple people. They're literally straight out of high school, maybe first year university. And they literally went in front of city council yesterday they all wore their keffiyehs, and they presented about how even though some of their MPs were responsive, most were not, and that the city actually has a responsibility to do something about this, because Brampton has companies that send parts that are eventually used to kill people in Gaza. And they did a really good job. I just want to make sure that they hold those city councilors accountable, because they were very open to what they brought to the table. They were very responsive. The mayor even was like, welcome, you guys can be in here with your keffiyehs. We're not Queen's Park. So they kind of made a dig. But at the same time, I'm waiting for the results, but I know that the Brampton kids have a lot of energy, so I'm actually pretty excited about them, especially since Brampton was, like, one of the first cities to recognize, to call for a ceasefire, like, way back. So the only other thing I wanted to say is, even if these ridings are not going to be the solution. I think making little groups is so great because it's just like anything else. It's networking. You don't all have to do the same thing. Everybody has their own little goals. Our goal is to bother Marco and make sure that nobody takes him seriously. Other people's goals are to actually, for example, I think Davenport got their MP to call for an arms embargo like a month ago. So I think we all have different goals. However, when we talk to each other, everybody can trade their skills and their information. And this helped Eglinton Lawrence a lot. Like, the only reason we're here is because we learn from other people. So I hope that groups keep growing. I hope everybody shares the land back goal for everybody, especially since Indigenous people here have actually been at the front lines of the pro-Palestinian movement. Somebody else should wrap up. I for real just had little thoughts that I wanted to throw in.
That's okay. I think as a collective there, the last three comments really did. I feel like you guys summarized the interview back up for the audience. And so I'll just leave it with a huge thank you to the folks here in the studio, as well as all of your comrades that helped get the work done. I know there was a bunch of people that could not make the time slot for today. And that just means I'll have to haul a whole bunch of you back in here a couple months from now or whatever to talk about your latest shenanigans and the fight for a free Palestine on the local level. So thank you very much for taking the time to come in here and keep disrupting. That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.